Hello, and welcome to I Am Dad Podcast with your fatherhood authority, Kenneth Braswell. 30 minutes of wisdom, information, resources, and nugget on your fatherhood journey. Or maybe you're just curious and want to hear some real talk about fatherhood, family, and the minds of men. Well, guess what? We got you too. Sit back, grab your pad and pen, and maybe even bring a little something to sip on. Enjoy 30 straight minutes of fatherhood, family, and fun with the Fatherhood Authority, Kenneth Braswell.
They've been so loud, they've been so loud for so long. He bullies you, you fight back. You need to know how to be tough, crush the competition in business. No quit attitude, you need to work a good job. Your self-worth is your net worth. Strengthen your network, work out, grow, get your gains. Build generational wealth. Oh, black man, be a pillar for your community. Be yourself, but actually be the version that we all want you to be. Show up, you're so toxic, heal yourself. Get girls, what your 401k looking like? Ask for help, but not too much, because then you're too soft. You're too soft, you're too hard. Why are you so angry? Why are you being short with me? You're an ass, and an ass gentle, love me back, just wait, hold on, it's too much water, and I know that I'm responsible for me, I'm responsible for the harm that I've caused, but I'm also responsible to work my way out of this trauma and teach myself how to swim. And what I'm saying is, it feels like a lot of water, and I'm tired of swimming alone. So when I tell you no, baby, I'm tired. When I say no, man, I'm good. When I say baby, I don't want to talk about it today. When I say please, just hold on, please just love me through this. I know I need to be better. What I'm really telling you is that I am drowning.
Welcome to I Am Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Kenneth Braswell. Welcome and thank you for joining us again. We are always so excited to have new listeners as well as our consistent listeners and those who have listened in the past and coming back periodically. We love you all, man. Just keep coming, keep sharing, keep talking about it. I could tell activity and engagement is going on, you know, by the increase of our analytics for the website. And for the podcast, you know, I think I've said this before, you know, we are still excited to know that, you know, based on FeedSpot, which is the analyzer of podcasts around the world, you know, that I Am Dad Podcast is number 5 out of 1,700 fatherhood podcasts around the world. And so that's no easy feat. I keep telling people when I started doing this podcast, I thought that I was going to do it because it was a fad. And then after a year, I would get bored with it and tired with it and leave and go do something else. And here we are in the middle of year 3, and this thing keeps on moving and keeps on impacting. And I think it's because of the clip that you just saw and my guest today. We're joined by the inimitable Jordan Holmes, also known as Dexter Spitz. Hailing from Prince George's County, Maryland, Jordan is a veritable Renaissance man, blending his as a scientist, engineer, musician, spoken word artist, and entrepreneur. A Virginia Tech alumnus and protege of the legendary Dr. Nikki Giovanni, Jordan carries a motto that echoes throughout his life and work: live life like an experiment. This ethos fuels his journey and his recent How Men Cry movement, which is reshaping conversations around masculinity, vulnerability, and mental health. Today, we uncover the layers of Jordan's multi-sensory performances that have cultivated moved audiences and dive into the lessons he imparts through his powerful a cappella spoken word. So let's get ready to be inspired by a story of innovation, expression, and emotional courage. Let's welcome Jordan to the space where fatherhood meets the frontiers of personal growth and societal change. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty well. It is absolutely great to see you. It's been a minute since I've seen you in person. I was thinking about it. I think it's been since 2014, actually. It was even longer than what I thought, almost 10 years since we took our trip.
Yeah, well, I try not to add any more years to my life than necessary. So I tend to pull it up a little bit. And so, but man, it's so great to see you. It's so great to see you on your grind, doing your work. I think we all, you know, were and still are, you know, impressed by who you are. And just, you know, doing the background stuff on you over the last couple of weeks, you know, has just been incredible to kind of uncover these nuances about you that I had no idea, you know, that you were, you know, connected to. So I'm excited to explore all of that stuff. Jordan, what we do on I Am Dad Podcast is something that we start out with because we think is relevant to the context, it's relevant to the audience, and then we always get to tie it in to the conversation a little bit. And I start all my guests off by asking this question. Tell me your daddy story.
So let's see. I haven't had the fortunate pleasure to be a father myself yet, other than being a dog dad. So I guess I got to go for my dad above me, right? You know, what's kind of wild is I almost want to start from now and go back a little bit. My father and I's relationship now is really great and communicative, you know, express what's going on, able to talk vulnerably with each other about pretty much anything under the sun. But that is a new thing, because for a pretty decent part of my life, there was conflict. And sometimes it was for things that I didn't fully understand were really going on with him. So my parents actually split when I was in about middle school or so. And, you know, what I've kind of come to see now is there were a lot of things that he was dealing with or processing or handling that he didn't really feel like he had the space to talk about, or didn't want to, I guess, change narratives or do the whole put one parent against the other thing and all these things. So I think I grew up in a way with a bit of distance from him and some of those reasons, even when we were close, you know, technically, physically close. I think, you know, there was still kind of barriers or stuff that I didn't really get. But what I will say is he for sure has always tried to be a presence, like good, bad, you know, right, wrong. He was always consistently trying to be there and trying to show up, you know, in the best possible way that he could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important to start, you know, this conversation that we have, particularly about men, by starting with our relationships, good or bad, specifically, or existing or non-existing, as it relates to our fathers, you know, because everybody has a father narrative. It's interesting because sometimes I'll ask that question and I'll get a deep pause. And then sometimes I'll ask that question and people will barrel right in.
Yeah.
But it always tells me something about them. And I think it's important for who we are, particularly as men, that we at least, if we don't understand the story, we recognize the story, right? And we recognize this impact on who we are and what it is we're trying to do. I've been kind of incorporating this second question, not often, but I do incorporate it every now and then, only because it gives me even deeper context to how we were taught, how we were raised, what our upbringing looks like, and what drives us to do what we do today. And the second question is, tell me your mommy story.
Yeah. So that one is even more complicated. I think, again, in a similar way, from them going through these periods of splitting, I think my mother, I mean, hands down for sure, there's lines of clear abuse and, you know, trauma that has impacted both of my parents. Like, I have enough of that context now within adulthood to know. And unfortunately, there's a lot of carrying down of those behaviors, right? When we don't have the tools and processes to heal. So I think with, you know, my mother, who I would definitely give the credit for, to say has also tried to always be a presence and show up, there's also been a lot of complexity there in our relationship because of almost just the very clear wounding of, I think, what happened from her parents to her, you know. So and I try to give a layer of grace, you know, for it. But I think my mother was for sure the more harsh parent. My father was probably the more resolved or kind of like, I don't know, nicer parent maybe. So with my mother, I think we clash heads a lot more than with my father for sure. But it to the point of a lot of what we're speaking on and we'll probably speak on further, I can see that the essence of it is people just trying to do the best that they could, you know.
Yeah. You are, I said in your intro, a Renaissance man. I love Renaissance men because I think that they are special children of God. I think that when God gives people the ability to have several talents and be very good at all of them, that there's a reason for those seven talents. Because I think that all of the men that I knew, all of the men that I personally know, and all of the men that I know in history that were Renaissance men who did a lot of things very greatly, that if you look over the span of their lives, those things were needed in their psyche to fill in blanks of absence. And it's not just absence of parents, it's absence of activity, it's absence of focus, it's absence of commitment. And so for those individuals, God has always recognized that I got to keep this guy busy and I got to allow him to be good at a lot of different things so he doesn't have time to rest in an empty space. When you think about all the things you do and all the things that you're great at and all the things that has become tools of what it is you're trying to do, do you ever resonate with, man, I got so many things in so many different directions, I feel like there ain't enough time in the day, and you're scrambling trying to figure out how to do it, but somehow you go to sleep really restful and you wake up really excited?
I mean, story of my life, basically. I think part of the Renaissance man curse is, I think, sometimes being pulled in so many directions that you have to focus it down. And but I love what you said around things maybe filling space at times when it was necessary or needed. And what I would say to that statement is I'm more comfortable and being okay with letting life play out as long as I'm following whatever part of that, whatever part of my motivation is the most alive for me in that given moment. So right now, to give an example, I had a background in a lot more music and performance with bands and other things like that. But my art has taken a shift where my spoken word material and voice is on the forefront for me right now. And I had a little bit of resistance in wanting to let that kind of be overtaken. But I found that when I just back off a bit where I can look at it with a little more space of, yeah, okay, I still make great music and I'll still release some of it here and there. I got a bunch of stuff within the vault. And at the same time, what I need to tell this story around manhood, masculinity, et cetera, right now is speaking to me louder within this particular form. So I just try to trust as those plates are spinning, I trust the one that seems the most alive for me within the moment.
You just released last month a song called I Need Space. And it is a, I think it was last month, it might have been last year, but it was recently. And so the song is about you recognizing that you need space and you need to take a break from reality, particularly from society. Do you think that that space, needing space, is moving you further from reality or closer to reality?
I would actually say closer, because I think, unfortunately, much of the, I think reality is relative. Let me start there. And I think that much of what we attach to as being needed within reality is not always what is true. And part of what that song is conveying is this attachment that we have to things like news and media and social media and imagery. And it's not that they're not real within the world, but there's, to some extent, where we are interacting with the world through a screen or interacting with people through a screen and not really being directly there to shake hands or, you know, to say hello and whatnot. And another big part of that as well, too, is we have lost our connection with much of the natural world to get out into nature. I'm actually going to go hiking after this today. which I feel like is a lot more real than what we give it credit for. We've almost got standoffish from nature sometimes of, oh, I can't be out there doing these things in the wild. And to me, I'm looking at it like this is this is the most real you can be, is to be here and to be present and to be still with how things are moving naturally. So I think it's bringing me closer to reality. Y'all probably just think I'm weird going out into the woods all the time, but it's cool.
Nah, I actually don't. I don't know, but maybe it's because I'm a Renaissance person too, and I tend to be comfortable with context, right? However that may look for someone, I don't dismiss the way someone sees something.
Sure.
So my quest is always to see it the way they see it, but to see them the way I see it.
Yeah.
And in somewhere in the middle, it makes sense for me.
Yeah.
Which leads me to this portion of your life that is the scientist, right? Because watching your stuff and watching your videos to that point, I get you. And it's like, okay, I'm watching. I get it. I get the context, but I also get the essence of what he's trying to convey and the essence of what he's trying to talk about. Talk to me about your inspiration to be a scientist, and talk to me a little bit about the professional side of that work, and then how that vocation moves into your creative side.
Yeah, so I would say the biggest motivation for me on the science side is curiosity. I think as a kid, I was extremely curious around either how things worked or maybe the histories or concepts and whatnot. And somewhere in my mind, I had this idea of, oh, if I just understand more about physics and chemistry and whatever, then I will have figured out the world or know more about what's going on. And for anybody who has ever been a researcher in the sciences or who has just tried to study physics or anything like that, all it's going to show you to some extent is that you still don't know anything. So even when you know a lot, you know, so I think, but what it had shown me in a lot of ways was how to add structure to different parts of my life, and also to look at things in a system thinking way. And and I would say in my professional journey with it, I've gone in research, I've gone in manufacturing, quality, these different aspects where you can get to see how things are made and like look through a process as through a whole. And I think that has inspired and assisted so much in art and in business, just from having a way to, I'm gonna lay out this concept in this story in a way that's super clear, or I think maybe most importantly, take these complicated pieces of data and information and put it into something that is digestible and clear. So.
Yeah, I love that, the part about the curiosity piece. I often say, when people ask me what, as a father, what is the best thing that you can leave with your children? And my answer is always curiosity. Like, none of people say love and all that. To me, all that stuff sounds cute. But my thing is curiosity.
Yeah.
I want them to have a thirst for knowing. Because that thirst for knowing allows them to expand who they are, understand more about their placement in the world as a citizen and then as an individual. It makes them understandable to themselves, and it makes them understandable to the world. And they never leave a room not wanting to know more.
Yeah.
Right. And so if they're in a learning environment like school, like what they're getting in school for my children is not enough. They want more. They want to know more. They want to dig deeper. And I think that that's one of the challenges in our community, that we don't put a high value on curiosity, right? Because we think curiosity is annoying, particularly for young kids, and I think it's particularly Black people in this country. We got to get away from command language with our children. And command language is stop, no, don't do this, do that, do as I say, not as I do. Be quiet, stand up, sit down. That's command language, and we don't give our children the space to be able to navigate and ask questions. And we never give them the comfortability to ask questions no matter where they are. And they're so used to command language that they don't get a chance to build that curiosity. And so I'm hoping that we get better in that space. Your academic journey allowed you to cross paths with Dr. Nikki Giovanni, and she has influenced you in many ways. Talk a little bit about Nikki and how she's influenced your life.
Nikki is probably just one of my favorite people, I think, on the planet. And not even because of the who she is from having a name. I think it's from who she is without all of that. You know, I there's a genuineness to her that I appreciate around just being able to speak her mind, no filter, and walk into the world. She said it within some of her poems before, but like walking into the world naked, you know, I think is such a powerful thing. And we originally met when I was in some of her creative writing classes. A funny story of how I even got to that class. I debated not taking it. And over the summer when I was in Seattle doing like an internship, when somebody learned that I went to Virginia Tech, they yelled at me in the middle of a party because I hadn't taken classes with Nikki Giovanni. So that was the final fire where I was like, I need to just go do this. I don't know what sometimes you're just hesitant for whatever reasons, but that I always use that as my mental cue as, all right, I needed to get into action. So when I did commit to going to her classes, there was just this kind of natural hitting off of she really appreciated a lot of my writing. We, you know, would kind of go back and forth around concepts and other things and just had a natural, you know, friendship really develop, mentorship develop. And just she's always been a consistent, positive presence. And, you know, we text, chat with each other here and there, even if we're not creatively working on something. She just really is a great friend and mentor.
When you look at her works and you look back at the works that she has done that has influenced you the most, can you see the science in her words?
Oh, yeah, I see. There's a. I mean, really, to the point that I was describing earlier, being able to take really complex either states of emotion, histories, imagery, whatever it may be, and put it into something that's simple and digestible. Like I like some of her longer form writing, but I really love some of her tremendously simple short poetry because there's you can read through so much of it and have just this, the moment when you back off the book for a second and you just like, where it hits that little, whatever it is in there, just, you get that little pen and it's, oh man. So, but I feel like having the skill set to do that from really complex topics, say it's related to gender or race or pain or trauma or even positive things, memories, happiness, just this real simplicity, I think within itself is this like methodical scientific approach, whether she would label it that way or not.
Live life like it's an experiment. Where'd that come from?
Some of it, I would say from a lot of personal reflection, because there were cards that I was dealt, some of them fine and positive, and some of them maybe not the best. And I think I got to a point internally that I realized that I needed to have more choice in how I was looking at my life. And to some extent, I couldn't continue to let life happen to me. It had to become more of a choice of what I wanted to do with my time and my energy. And, you know, the back end of that statement is you can't control what happens to you, but you can control the product that you become. And I have really tried to take that quite literally within life, of not necessarily in a rigid way of I need to control everything. Life still will happen around you, but I definitely have choice in how I can approach whatever is going on.
Yeah, see, I think as you were saying that, I was also thinking I would add to that about controlling life, because when that term experiment comes up, it takes me back to curiosity, right? And curiosity allows you not to be afraid to experiment. So it's not only to know that you can live life and not allow life to do that, but you can't be fearful of what the outcome is going to be of your actions and or your experiment. Mm-hmm. That's what makes people great. Like, they're not afraid. Like, people walk in and say, oh man, if I take this risk, you know, it's not going to turn out, or it might not turn out the way I want it to turn out. So they'll turn away from it as opposed to turn into it, you know, because they don't want to experience let that. And it's kind of like, no, you have to be fearless against experiment and choices and risk. Now, we have to take calculated risks. We have to calculate. That's the science of it, right? We have to pre-calculate experiment. You just don't go in and put, you know, an explosive next to fire and say, let me see what this is going to work out to be. You haven't already, like, figured out that once you put them together, it's going to blow up and you're going to blow up too. Like, you got to put some science into it. And then I think there also has to be some faith in it, right? Which is, I know enough, I understand enough of what I know to know that whatever happens, it's not going to be so devastating that it's going to destroy who I am, right? And it's not going to weaken me. It's going to strengthen me if I'm not afraid to be able to explore. You began now starting to do this work around men and mental health, the How Men Cry movement. Talk to me a little bit about what inspired you to begin to start thinking about mental health and men.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, the inspiration behind wanting to do more with men's mental health came from me looking at my own journey through a process of therapy and healing. And one of the main resiliency factors and tools that I've had is writing. And I began a process of therapy after being in like a failed relationship or circumstance that was really not working out for anybody. A lot of my trauma and wounding, you know, was causing harm within relationship. And I was writing out a lot of the reflections through therapy in the form of spoken word or poetry or whatever it may be. Not necessarily with the intention to use it, but I think with just the intention of getting the information out. And when I began to, I shared some of those pieces with even some like close friends, and I got the encouragement at the time of, this is stuff that people need to hear, because vulnerability being expressed in this way, especially for men, isn't necessarily happening all the time. And honestly, from just those moments of encouragement and also realizing the response when men in particular would hear some of these pieces, really just encourage this idea of like, all right, this is the place that I want to go. And it's since just kind of grown legs and blossom to the point where, I mean, now I do speakings with companies or, you know, groups, organizations, whoever wants to bring us in, and as well as hosting men's retreat events, like, and just working on really changing narratives around men's mental health, but then also destigmatizing the way that we talk about mental health as a whole, and spoken word in particular, and meditation and mindfulness, journaling. They're all kind of tools that I'll put together to make it easier and more creative to talk about what's going on internally, because I think people are also getting a little tired of just hearing, well, just go to therapy and then life will be fixed or be better. You know, I think it has to get a little more life to it for people to really connect with it.
Mm-hmm. When you're sitting in the midst of a group of men and you guys are talking about whatever it is you're talking about, what tends to be the most prevalent theme when you're talking to men, particularly about their mental health?
You know, I think a lot of men genuinely do not feel cared for or feel like their vulnerability is okay to express, even when it sometimes is encouraged to be expressed. So there's almost a punishment that can come along with trying to be a vulnerable man for whatever reason in the way that society is structured at this given moment, or the way that sometimes our relationships are structured. So I hear, you know, a lot of guys who maybe want change or want to be more open or want to be able to talk about what's going on, but they don't feel like they have the space or that they're really accepted with open arms to be going through difficulty.
Yeah, 10 years ago, I did a documentary called Spitting Anger, addressing the anger within particularly Black men and boys as a result of not having their fathers in their lives. And I had the chance to interview Ayala Van Zandt. And one of the things, Jordan, she said to me is, she says, men don't have an acceptable language to express what they deeply feel. And so because there is no language, it's very hard for them to speak, and it's very hard for people to understand them. Mm-hmm. When you're talking to these men, do you get a sense that oftentimes they really don't know how to identify and then express exactly where mental health and mental issues are having an impact on their lives?
You know, I would say yes and no. There are circumstances where I can see, I feel like they can express themselves within the context of the spaces that they are in, you know, when we're having those conversations. Okay. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are doing it with that close partner or that friend or you know, whatever it may be where they need to use the skill. So I don't want a blanket statement, just say, no, they're perfectly fine to talk. But what I've found is that if given the space and if the container is created in a way where they feel safe enough, vulnerability will pour out. Now, to some extent, though, I guess the flip side of why I would say I do think that the language isn't always there, because I think sometimes it's hard for us to put our finger on a particular feeling, or maybe our finger on a particular need, or be able to express things in a way that's healthy, because a lot of the social conditioning that's also been placed on men has been placed in a way where it's just not common patterning that we see. And a really easy, simple example would be, when I hear of my friends who are women, if they're going through a breakup or if they have a moment of complexity or something, they'll go talk to 17 friends about what's happened, you know, what's happening, or we gonna have this girls night, we gonna do this, this and that. And they'll go in collectively about what's going on internally. Not all, you know, but I would say it's more common. And for us, sometimes I won't necessarily even now, now I'm a lot better at it, but it took a minute for me to say, hey, so-and-so, I'm going through this moment of difficulty. Even if I don't need the advice, let me just talk about what's going on so that it's not sitting with me. And I think, you know, a lot of men are not socialized to go seek that space, or they have a hard time finding it with other men because it becomes kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If two of us are not really equipped to express in that way, then there's no way we're going to bridge that gap together. And that's part of what I try to assist with is, okay, how can we have this space where it's a little easier for us to do this? I think a lot of men's healing will happen within community more than what we realize.
Yeah, I often wonder when it comes to women who seek their own circles for comfort and advice when they're going through things, whether or not the value of that for them is just the interaction and the feedback and not necessarily solution. Mm-hmm. Where men who walk into a space don't really put a lot of value on connecting with others, but they are always in search of the solution. Do you think that is the case most times?
Yeah, and I definitely have got the fixer response for sure of, oh man, you're just going through a thing. Let me just tell you about the thing. So in that way, I would say yes. And I try to reframe it sometimes where I'm like, the intention behind this is that somebody sees somebody suffering and they want to help, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of guys listening for the sake of listening, or even just listening to mirror back, or asking a really simple question, do you want feedback or do you just want to talk it out, you know, kind of thing, is powerful. But if we're not necessarily modeled that, right, and if what is also viewed as valuable, I think a kind of undercurrent in that is what is viewed as valuable for men quite often is for you to be able to have the solutions, for you to always be able to be confident in your decisions, for you to be able to produce something that resolves or fixes the stuff. So I think that there's like a there's like an undercurrent narrative within our society sometimes of how men need to show up to have value, which probably doesn't, you know, help that.
Mm-hmm. What's the two principles that should be in a room for fathers and for men in particular to walk into a room and receive help? Like if someone is trying to create a support group, mm-hmm. or trying to create something and they really want to serve men but really don't know about the importance of the environment, what are two things that needs to be in that environment or not in order for them to be successful at doing that?
Well, I'll give a personal super biased opinion on one of them. I think sometimes you got to get them out the room. A lot of what I do with guys is hike. And we'll actually hike in silence quite often. Because I think one of the things that they need is a felt sense of space, even if they are in community. And I know that may seem like counterintuitive, but enough space away from what I would say is like, the pressure of needing to have a solution for something. I think that's so, you know, in the containers that I'll have guys, we go out, we'll hike, I'll ask some pointed questions at times for them to be able to like reflect and journal. But it's really so that they have the, they can have a moment to look at somebody and know that he's in his own world and I'm in my own world, you know, but they're also in arm's reach. And by the time we bring them back to actually have conversation, they are more ready to be open just from that presence alone. But what I would say, maybe another principle, a felt sense of non-judgment within a room, because there's a lot of criticism that goes towards men, and I can understand why, like right or wrong, of how this criticism in society has kind of developed, but it's definitely present. And I think part of why a lot of men don't feel heard is because they don't feel like they can say what they really need to express or what they're wrestling with without a repercussion in some type of way. I can't say, you know, how I really feel about something, because if I appear too vulnerable, then I don't appear equipped for this job or equipped for this relationship. Or if I, you know, if I say this thing that sounds too controversial, then I'm canceled in this way, or somebody hates me for that, whatever it is, where I think if there's just a sense of, hey, we're in this space just to be with like one another, and we're creating a container that's also safe, but also a container where you can be yourself, is, I think, crucially important.
Yeah, you talk about the hiking and being outdoors. What's the component of being outdoors that tends to be something that's necessary for men to have?
So there's a philosophy called forest bathing, which I think is crucially important for people, which is to be able to get into natural environments, to hear bird song, to be around the scents of trees, all these things where our bodies naturally developed. And we're so far from it quite often in the concrete jungles that we live in, that I think it's crucially important for us to get back in touch with that. And then secondly, another principle that I'm looking at is the fact of like motion. There's a lot of information out there around like bilateral stimulation and stuff, where essentially if you're going to go for a run, or if you go for a walk, I guess maybe it would be a question is like, have you ever noticed when you go for a walk or a run that maybe the thoughts that were buzzing around kind of settle a bit? There's a whole bunch of in-depth research around this stuff, but basically the mind is able to get into a different rhythm when you're in motion like that. So I'm kind of using this combined sense of being in nature as well as hiking, and then adding in some silence, because it's a very loud environment in general. It's loud with our cell phones, it's loud with opinions, and I mean loud more than just physical sound, but just the amount of input noise, the volume of noise that we're swimming in. So giving guys a moment to not have to respond to that, and in a way it's kind of a gentle invite to like a meditation or mindfulness practice, because they're able to be with their thoughts and not necessarily have to do anything with them. They're not necessarily having to talk about them at the time. They're not necessarily, they can just become observers of their mind and body. And that's stuff that I'll encourage prior to hiking. But a really, really thoughtful curation of that experience, because of how valuable and effective that I've seen it be.
Mm-hmm. When you engage in your creative space, I'm curious as to whether or not you have one singular method or message you're trying to get out there, or is it varies depending on what piece of creative art you are engaged in. I could tell you that as I listened to many of your songs, when I walked away from them, I was probably more aware than educated, meaning that you would say something that I would be able to connect to, and it would make me aware that this thing that I was feeling or this thing that I was going through is real because someone else recognizes it, rather than being educated about something that I didn't know. Like when you create and get into your creative space, what is it that you're trying to get people to walk away with?
Yeah, I mean, I think you articulated it really well. I try to create in a way that gives people a felt sense of something, a more visceral experience of things if I can. And that's why I try to utilize a lot of storytelling, even if it's in short form. So for a lot of spoken word material, you can say it's spoken word or poetry, but really it's storytelling, because I don't want you sure, you can hear my story, you can empathize with my story, whatever it is, but I don't actually really want that from you as the audience. What I want from the audience is for them to connect it to their story in whatever type of way, you know, so it can be, hey, yeah, Dexter said this thing or he had this line, but what's more important to me is how it resonates with your own personal journey. So, you know, I would say that's definitely a lot of the motivation behind most of my creation is I would like that felt sense. And then also there's a component of just being creative for the sake of being creative. I try to find a lot of play within my creativity, sometimes just like silliness, laughter. I mean, a lot of my stuff has, to me, little subtle moments of silliness in it. Or I try to sprinkle in, you know, little moments of silliness, especially with visuals or music videos and stuff. Because there's a lot of negative or intense energy going out into the world either. I mean also. And I feel like I just try to not add any more of that if I don't need to.
Yeah, there's certain songs that, you know, when you listen, I've been listening to a lot of conscious music lately, a lot of conscious hip hop, particularly from the 1980s and early 1990s, you know, music that we miss and artists that we kind of gave some level of recognition back then, but didn't give them all the recognition that they deserved, like Common and Mos Def and, you know, and others. And so, and it's crazy because listening to some of that and then listening to yours, it allowed me to kind of hear other songs differently, right? And one of the songs that kept popping up in my head while I was listening to is Eminem's My Name Is. And it's kind of like this song that kind of really talks about and an introduction to who he is, but it was more of an expression of how he saw himself and how he thought people saw him and an unleashing of things that he needed to say that would help him mentally. Do you listen to music like that when you're listening to music, even in your pleasure spaces? Are you kind of really listening for the consciousness in music?
Oh, yeah. I think two things I probably enjoy the most out of music is one, a lot of complexity that's put together in a way that it still sounds like, in particular with music, that it sounds or gels really well. So that can be lyrical complexity, the music complexity, just things that stimulate so many parts of the mind where I can go back to hear something and, you know, discover something new out of it a few times through. So that's one piece. And then secondly, yeah, a lot of the times for the point of the more consciousness pieces of it, I hear. It is fascinating to me to even think about what is it like to be in this person's shoes at the place of writing or creating this. And, you know, not to go too far on a soapbox, but part of why I'm not a huge fan of a great deal of where music has gone now, especially in an extremely pop sense, the authenticity of that creative piece of like, this is my heart and soul being poured into something, kind of gets diluted. I'm not going to say always, but it's hard. And when the idea is, I just want to sell you something that you can dance to, I'm like, okay, that's fine too. But there's something different when somebody has a piece of rawness that is like, you know, this is real, real, real me coming through these speakers. And, I think just truly moving in a way kind of weaves together the human experience as a whole. Because yes, our experience sometimes is dancing, partying and whatnot, but the majority of your time is living in a very, a real, you know, experience of complexity. And yeah, there's many artists that I think can hit that vein that I appreciate. Yeah.
Who's your favorite who's your favorite hip hop artist and why?
Favorite's a hard. That's a hard. favorite is too hard. It's like I would have to pick a few, but one, I would say one of the influences, a rabbit hole that I've gone on recently. I was definitely a big Nas fan for in, you know, multiple periods of his writing and music. And in recent time, like literally this past week, I kind of went on a rabbit hole again. And just some of the writing and creativity there, I think for him has been really powerful. So that's definitely a big influence, but it's hard to say favorite. Favorite's tricky.
Yeah. It's almost like pick your favorite child. Like you don't really want to, you might be thinking it, but you still don't want to say it.
But
your answer to this may be the answer to this second one. I'll be curious if it's different than what you just said. And that is, in your estimation, who is the most underrated rapper of all time and why?
Ooh, underrated. I think Nas has probably been given his flowers maybe more than some other artists. Definitely still underrated. People appreciate him, but from a pure writing ability, Andre 3000, who does get a decent amount of credit, but from a standpoint of writing versatility and putting, I think, really being able to find any style of music and essentially write to it and still bring a level of consciousness and thought. Like he would go on remixes of party songs and still have you think about something deep. I'm like, how did you do that? I'm like, we were talking about Walk It Out and you didn't Brock out. I'm like, how did you? and that ability where it wasn't like stylistically, I'm just gonna be super flashy or rap fast or do this, do that. It was just like simple, clear, and complex all at the same time. So from just a strictly writing standpoint, I think he might be pretty underrated as a whole, where maybe folks in my generation, a little older, may appreciate him, but he's like probably not really communicated about as much now.
Mine is, oh my goodness, his name just jumped right. Scarface.
Oh, that's
a good
one. I
just think Scarface.
Too. Yeah.
Did you see this thing with Scarface where he did his whole, he did like his top 10 songs in poetry with a band? It was in a library. I have to send you the link to this thing, man. This thing, I sat and I watched that thing and like he takes you back to these songs and he's literally just in the middle of this room. I've seen several artists do this thing. It's in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's in the UK. And they bring these artists into this, like, it's almost like a library. It's a really weird place. Yeah. And they bring a band around them. And then the artists just, like, it's their space. They get to, like, create, but use their, they get to recreate their music in a way that they want to recreate their music.
Yeah.
And he did one of them. And it was the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life. I have to send you the link. It's Scarface.
Please
and I can't remember the
venue. Scarface is it. That's a good pick. Yeah.
Yeah. Him and Exhibit. Exhibit for me is another one that I think, to your point about flowers, has never really been given his flowers when he was solely an artist. But as people have more recognized him for songwriting and for producing, beginning to recognize this man's talent and who he is. And then if I'm going back old school, it would be Big Daddy Kane.
Mm-hmm.
And so because folks just, you know, he was caught up in an era where there were so many other more popular rappers that it was really hard to kind of hear his genius.
Yeah.
And then the one that I struggle with, because as you talk about flowers, he gets his flowers all the time. But I don't really think he gets his flowers because of his genius. He gets his flowers because of the popularity of his songs, and that's Rakim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's different for me with him. Like, if you listen, there was a guy who did a comment on one of your songs, and I laughed when I saw it, and it's what actually made me think about this question. And he was somebody from another country. Mm-hmm. And his comment was, I'm sitting here from wherever it is he is, and he says, my head hurts trying to figure out how you came up with doing and creating this song. It was like, really? And when I read it, I was like, yo, that's deep. That's somebody who's listening to your stuff deep. Yeah. They're like listening to the music, but their mind is in, yo, I just need to be, to your point, I just would love to have been in his mind as he was creating this thing, because it's something different. Man, Jordan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, man, talking to you. I love seeing your work, and I'll be, you know, following your work and trying to figure out how to get you into this space to talk more, you know, about this whole notion of men and mental health, because it is probably one of the most critical conversations we need to have today as it relates to men, more specifically to Black men. And so to help us find a space to be able to address those things that more often than not, we don't have a language to express, and people don't value the mental aspects of our lives. They're more focused on the physical aspects of our lives and the financial contribution aspects of our lives. Or what we can do for you. But no one is having big conversations on making sure that as we ask all of these things of you, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Right? Nobody starts with that. How you're doing? What are you thinking? We have a progressive model at Fathers Incorporated to which everything that we do follows this progressive model. And it is, if I want to change what you do, I have to change how you think. If I want to change how you think, I have to change how you feel. I can't do very deep work with men unless I'm addressing how they feel. I have to dig into their hearts to understand what they're feeling, because if I can figure that out, I can change how they're thinking. And if I can change how they're thinking, I can change what they're doing. And part of your work, at least a lot, large part of what you're doing, is in that space. What you're doing, whether you recognize it or not, is really digging into the hearts of men, right? So that they begin to feel a different way about themselves. Worthiness was a word you used in the beginning. Respect it. All of those things start in the heart. They don't start in the mind. Mm-hmm. I can't tell a guy, I can't tell you that, oh man, I respect you. That don't mean nothing if you don't feel it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
it don't mean nothing. Tell people how they can get in touch with you and see your work.
Sure. So you can find everything for How Men Cry at howmencry.com. That's howmencry.com. That'll show more information about how you can find us to come in and speak. And that's for all gender speaking presentations. And then also the retreats that we do with men local to Chicago, working on some travel ones as well too. And then you can find Dexter Spitz on most platforms, just DXTR Spitz. You type that in into the interwebs, Instagram or Spotify, Apple Music, any of that, it'll pop up.
Man, thank you so much. And I appreciate you, bro. And thank you to all of my I Am Dad podcast listeners. I really appreciate you for joining us on another episode. You know how I like to leave you. Always be, hey, you know what? I got to stop this because I actually wanted you to do this. We got to end this show. You got to spit me at least some piece of work. It could be long. It could be short. But I need to hear your genius. Something acapella you got that's meaningful to this conversation. I needed you to kick that before we end this.
Let me see. Something that's meaningful for this conversation in particular. I want to take a section out of a piece.
Okay.
So there's a piece Oh, put me on the spot. I'm trying to think. I have a couple concerts. I think I'm just gonna go with a stanza out of one of them, because I think it conveys the importance of looking back into how a lot of things form with us. Like, I want to go from where we began, which is the mother and father figures early on. There's a piece that I have that's called Castle, and there's a statement out of it. A 7-year-old boy made his home inside a castle. He didn't ask to be placed there. He did it to survive. He could have really used a hug. He could have really used some love. He laid the foundation brick by brick. And that's one of the initial stanzas of it. But on the back end, it gets to this point of a 30-year-old man made his home inside a castle. He didn't ask to be placed there. He did it to survive. He mans the drawbridge. He can no longer allow anything in. He can no longer allow himself to be hurt. He can no longer laugh because it hurt. He can no longer laugh because it hurt. He can no longer laugh because it's hurting. He cries when no one is looking. He finally found his voice by telling his story. He told his story even when he hated the words that he can finally get out, even if it took what felt like an eternity. He didn't ask to be placed there, but he found his way to survive. And that's relevant, I think, to our conversation, because oftentimes we have created ways to make ourselves feel safe, whether we knew it or not, I think, in childhood into adulthood. And part of the complicated work for a lot of men at this stage in the game, you know, if you're getting older and maturing as a man, is to understand that maybe the castle walls that we had earlier on in life are not always necessary now. And we have to figure out ways to let down the drawbridge, to allow love in, and to allow new experiences so that we can heal.
This is Jordan Holmes, y'all, a.k.a. Dexter Spitz. You know how I like to leave you? Always be kind to others as you're kind to yourself, or you might find yourself by yourself. Always shoot high for your goals, because even if you miss, you'll be amongst the stars. And that's my good friend and mentor, Art Mitchell, always said to me, it's nice to be important, but you know what? It's much more important to be nice. Till next Sunday, peace out.
Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us. You've been listening to I Am Dad Podcast. We hope that you have been informed, encouraged you to think, or even inspired your heart for the love of dads. The conversation does not end here. Come back and join us next week. Same time, same place. Or you can continue the dialogue on our I Am Dad Facebook page. We also invite you to listen to past episodes, learn more about us, and keep up with special activities by visiting IamDadPodcast.com. That's IamDadPodcast.com. Until next time. I leave you with this reminder of manhood from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. Because of this reminder, I will always understand that I am dad, period.